Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There is a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. Catherine Georgeson, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Mark.
As a child, Catherine knew two things for certain. She would become an architect, and she was not a boy. Catherine has a very unique perspective. She has witnessed and experienced the profession from the perspective of two genders. We discussed gender stereotyping here in the podcast in the past, and we've discussed the frustration of gender stereotyping in the private Entree Architect community Facebook group in the past. It's an important issue. My wife, who's also an architect, she's a licensed architect, she's my business partner, she leads all of the architectural services in our firm. She experiences the profession differently than I do as a man. She's treated differently, she's respected differently. She needs to earn her credibility every time as a professional. Every time she meets someone, she needs to earn that credibility as an architect. Catherine is a very accomplished architect. She's an acclaimed architect with dozens of design awards. She's a fellow of the American Institute of Architects. She's an active member in the Entree Architect community, and she has a very interesting story. And I wanted to learn that story. I wanted to hear that story and share it with you. So Catherine, thank you very much for coming on and joining with me today on this podcast.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm glad to be here with you.
I'm looking forward to this conversation. Let's start with your origin story. When did you discover your passion for architecture, and who or what inspired you to become an architect?
Well, as you sort of alluded to in your statement on me, it was forever. I mean, it was from a young child on, I was always building things. If it was Lincoln Logs or American bricks, or those were before Legos, I had a train set, an HO train set, very early on, and was always working on that and building the buildings on the set and the scenery and new layouts and that. We also lived in the city I grew up in, or the town I grew up in, the university was across the street. And this was the late 50s and 60s. And they were on a building boom. So there was always construction going on around us. The neighborhood was full of these old Victorian homes. And as they would expand the university, instead of demoing them, they would move them. So every once in a while, there'd be big house moving down the street, and they would move them to to the suburbs or the outskirts of town, and build these little cul-de-sacs of historic Victorian homes. The town was an old lumber town, so these huge homes were all magnificently detailed and had just incredible woodworking and that even at that time they couldn't part to tear down. So we grew up in a large Victorian. Literally two houses down from me was a Frank Lloyd Wright home, one of his minor works, but you know, it was very different in this neighborhood.
Yeah.
And the university and the museum. So we were always just sort of experiencing all this different sort of art and architecture. Thinking back, I think my grandmother was probably a frustrated architect or wanted to be an architect, because she would always drive us around to the construction site. So on the weekends, we'd tour homes under construction. So again, this was a big building boom era.
Yeah.
So we'd walk through homes under construction. We'd drive through downtowns, and she would tell us about how there should be mixed use development and that people should be living upstairs and the rest, you know, and all this kind of stuff. We talk about today is how to rejuvenate a downtown and that. So she designed her own house, which is still a magnificent modern sort of statement.
What was your grandmother's background?
She was a small business. Her parents owned a grocery store, butcher shop. So she more or less got that business, although, you know, then her husband, my grandfather, took that over. But she ran the business side, and he did all the sort of
front. do you have any idea, because clearly she was inspired by architecture, she was interested in it, she wanted to teach you about architecture, do you have any idea why she was so interested in it? I mean, to take your grandchildren on a ride to construction sites and tour houses under construction is not typical. So I'm wondering, you know, what inspired that in her? Do you know?
Yeah, I don't really know, you know, and when you're a kid, this is just what you do, right?
I mean, right, exactly.
How long? But, you know, thinking back on her and hearing different stories, you know, from my mother, things that I didn't realize, that I had always assumed were sort of, you know, driven by my grandfather, were really driven by her. So she definitely was a very independent woman and very headstrong.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the time and that always sort of had to take a back seat, you know. They had two daughters, my mother and my aunt. My aunt went into small business, ran beauty shops. I mean, that again was something that, you know, women did at that time.
Yeah.
And my mother, that was what my mother was supposed to do, but she kind of like went off, you know, and started the family and everything. But when she went back to work, she went back at a manufacturing company, and sort of worked her way up through, you know, key punch operator to an engineer, project manager on some pretty major, it was a truck manufacturer, a pretty major development of one of their major product lines. So, you know, it was always these sort of, yes, I had the boy's perspective or the guy's perspective, or, you know, at that time. It was always strong women around me. And I thought that was just the way the world was. I didn't know. And it being across from the university, and the neighbors were all professors, and some were faculty, some, you know, and that. So it was a very sort of socially liberal sort of area that we were in. So,
Do you remember the moment that you understood what an architect was and decided you wanted to do that?
It was really early on. My uncle, my aunt's wife, husband, had a friend who was a developer, residential developer in Milwaukee. So they would always get the blueprints for me.
Yeah.
So I was always getting these blueprints and looking at it. And my dad had a friend who was also a designer, who was a house designer. In Wisconsin, you can be a residential designer.
Yeah.
He wasn't an architect, but he was a residential designer. So we would go and talk to him and visit him. Oddly enough, it was like he was godparents to my brother, who could care less about any of this stuff. My brother, so he would always send the sketching pads and the, the architectural books and all that to my brother. And then again, I would steal those. And everybody knew that this is what I was interested in.
Yeah.
It was just that, he didn't necessarily put it all together. So it was very early on. So, I definitely had, by second grade, I was pretty, by third grade, I had a drafting station and all my equipment and was, was a drafting.
So it sounds like you had no choice. You were surrounded, by architecture. You were being fed architecture. You were being given the tools of architecture. You were touring them with your grandmother.
Yes.
It was like you were being bred to be an architect.
Yes, I have no choice. You go back to high school reunions and that, and people say, "Oh, you're really smart because you continued through as being an architect." And I'd be like,
right.
"No, I don't know how to do anything else."
Right, exactly. I'm the same way. I decided when I was 10 and I put the blinders on and never looked.
Else. Now within architecture, there's a broad scope of things you can do. And I always felt it was, the two things I always felt it was that sort of Renaissance person. And that the other thing that attracted me was that it was a career that never had to end. That you could do it. You could just keep doing it. And there was all the stories, Frank Lloyd Wright and, architects that are going on until their 80s or 90, and that's really appealing to me. I love that fact of it, that I can always just continue to do what I love doing.
So you went to university and you worked for several architecture firms. When did you start your own architecture firm?
I started it twice. I started one twice. The first firm that I worked for was also a startup right out of school. A couple professors and a couple students, and we got a great job. The firm started. It was very talent. A lot of talent, a lot of hot ego, a lot of and things exploded. and then I continued on sort of with those, because I had been done doing a lot of the marketing and design and that. So I continued on with a lot of those clients and use that as a basis to start a firm. So I that was in the 90s, about 92. And we were modestly successful. We grew to about four people. We were getting, I was continuing to work in the arts and the performing arts and cultural projects, which is what the first firm was had focused on. So that was great. It was a wonderful, it's a wonderful building type, wonderful clients. They're so passionate about what they're doing.
And that's what you focus on now as well?
And I still try to focus on that.
So did you do that all the way through? Did you sort of be introduced to it in that first firm? And then even though you worked for other firms, did you focus on that building type?
That was always my focus. That's always been my focus. Yeah. In fact, that's what started the first firm. They had gotten the founders had gotten an NEA grant to study regional theaters. And then that morphed into designing a regional theater for the Milwaukee, and the firm started off that. We had at that time there was a major recession going on. We had the largest project in the state of Wisconsin So, you know, and then we won a couple international competitions and, you know, we thought life was perfect.
Yeah. So today you have Orchestra Design Studio. When did you start that?
So that started in about 2013. I had, again, been with a firm and we were to kind of focus on this. We had some, you know, disagreements on how that should go. We just said, well, you know, let's just move on, you know, so we did. And we still worked and I consulted with them for a while and back and forth and that. So it's, you know, and during that time is, you know, and that's when I started transitioning.
With orchestra?
Yeah. Yeah. I had always been Catherine with orchestra. But, you know, going back and forth with the previous firm, I really started transitioning sort of under the radar in like 2010, 2009, mm-hmm. somewhere around in that area.
So most of your profession, you were a man.
Yes.
And then when you started, and so you started transitioning somewhere in the 2000s, is that what you said?
Yeah. 2000.
And then when you started orchestra, you were Catherine with orchestra.
Yes. I mean, there was that edgy time when you're sort of, you have to have both hats on, so to speak. I didn't know how every client would take it. You know, again, fortunately, being in the arts, it's a pretty... You'd hope it's a pretty
it's a good
open
building line, type to make a
group.
Transition.
And for the most part, they were. I mean, I even came out at you know to the whole my whole industry and peers and everybody at a theater conference.
Wow!
So you sort of about that.
You made the announcement on stage, basically.
Basically.
Wow, that's one way to do it.
It was a session on gender, and I thought, what better time? I mean, you know, this was back. You know, everyone was debating the bathroom bills and all that mm-hmm. stuff, and how do we react to it as a profession, and how does the architectural engineering theater world help address, you know, work with their clients to address gender neutrality and gender, you know, what impacts does that have on architecture? And how do we, you know, work that through help our clients get through this? So I thought, perfect.
So did you have clients that you worked with both genders? Or was there a clean
break
between clients?
I did. The one and a couple of them. One in particular was actually the one that I used that I started the firm with. It was a small group in mid-state Wisconsin that was trying to do a restoration of a theater, and so. I started that, had worked with them for about a year, and then that was the fallout. It was like, well, that project's too small for us. We don't want to deal with that. And I'm like, we can't just drop them, you know? So I'll take this and do it myself.
Yeah.
So they knew me as male. And then the project went on hold for, well, it went on hold during my transition time. And when it came back, I went over and I talked to him, and I was probably a little more androgynous. I was just to tell him, you know, I didn't want to shock him. I just,
right.
The project had changed a little bit, that it was more of a community center than a theater restoration, because that's where the money was in the city. That's what they had determined through their marketing, that there was better, more support there, which is fine.
Yeah.
So when I told them their response was, you know, everyone was like, well, you know, we want what's in your head, not, we don't care what you look like. But the real response that I always go back to is you represent exactly what we're trying to achieve. We want to, you know, it's a small town, not very diverse, they're saying, but we want to entice, we want to show that we're welcoming diversity.
Yeah. You know, so it was actually
transgender architect is perfect for that.
Yeah. It fit their brand.
It fit their brand. Now, I did have one client, maybe two, that said, fine, you know, we're fine with it and fine with it. But though, as the project progressed, you could tell they were not fine with it.
Yeah.
And they were not easy. And they had actually asked me to come to a couple, because we get involved in, you know, selling it to the supporters and the donors and, you know, and that, and a lot more of public appearances and so forth to promote the projects. I mean, that's, and they had started asking me even after the transition, just to, well, can you show up in a suit and tie again? You know, can you? And it just started getting awkward in the sense that I had sat through one board meeting and they started, there was a couple of women on the board and they just started shutting them down. You know, I brought a tax expert because they were talking about tax credits, who basically wrote many of, you know, it was very involved in writing some of the local tax credits. She wasn't good enough. Well, you know, so I'm like, okay, I see where this is going.
Right.
So, you know, I resigned commission. I just couldn't see it. You know, at some point it was going to end anyways.
Yeah.
So, you know, why put everybody through that? And there was another project that just, it rushed to the end and then ended, you know, and they just didn't want to.
Yeah.
But that, you know, it's not fine. I understand. I can see where they would feel maybe it was a bait and switch. So I can appreciate that. I'm not so forgiving now.
Yeah.
Because they kind of know what they're getting. Right. You know, so if I'm misgendered or something, I take a breath and I sort of correct them and, you know, so we do spend some time on proper etiquette.
Yeah.
And that.
So is that something you actively have to do when you meet someone new to work with? Or does it depend on the person?
It depends on the group. I mean, again, sort of the arts groups, and the groups, you know, a lot of times by the time the groups have felt comfortable enough to work with me. And they kind of know the story. A lot of times I don't address it up front. Yeah. I feel they know. And then you get in those weird situations. Is like, well, do they know? Do I tell them? I don't know. I mean, they've never met me before. I don't know.
Yeah. Let's take a break to thank our sponsors for their support of this episode. As architecture demand increases toward pre-pandemic levels and beyond, how are you and your architecture firm keeping up? RCAT is here to help. RCAT.com offers several free tools to help architecture and design firms like yours get work done faster. Use RCAT's powerful search engine to find the right products for your projects and download BIM, CAD, and specifications right there on the same page without needing to pay or register. It's free. RCAT.com also offers product videos, catalogs, green reports, product certification information, outline and short form specification generation, and so much more. Visit RCAT.com today. RCAT.com is your one-stop solution to help increase your productivity and get more projects done faster. That's RCAT.com, A-R-C-A-T.com. FreshBooks makes it simple to send invoices, post your expenses automatically, track your time for your whole team by project, and get organized with financial reports, communication, and notifications. My favorite feature in FreshBooks is the automated invoice reminders. I think sending invoices and getting paid is one of the biggest barriers to our success as entrepreneur architects. Who has the time? But if we don't send out the invoices, we don't get paid, right? FreshBooks makes it easy to send out your invoices and get paid fast, online, with a click of a button. And when your client doesn't pay you on time, FreshBooks will send them a friendly email reminder through a simple system that you control. Sign up for a free 30-day unrestricted trial and get ready for the simplest way to be more productive, organized, and most importantly, get paid faster. Go to entrearchitect.com/freshbooks and enter Entree Architect in the How Did You Hear About Us section. That's entrearchitect.com/freshbooks. In the last few years, premium outdoor spaces have become a must-have architectural feature. And Infratech outdoor electric heating systems have become the brand of choice among leading architects. Infratech heaters provide energy-efficient ambient warmth that allows homeowners to live outdoors during cooler months. Clients love them because they can enjoy 100 more nights a year outside. Architects love them because of their unparalleled versatility. From heater capacities and colors to mounting options that can either seamlessly disappear or accentuate a space with beautiful decorative coverings. They're also the only comfort heat company to offer smart home integration and hands-free voice-activated control. For over 60 years, Infratech has made their products in the USA at competitive prices. They offer incredible design and live technical support at every stage of a job. A few years ago, I was visiting Sonoma Wine Country in California. It was during the autumn, so it was a bit cool when the sun dropped below the horizon. One evening, we joined a group of friends for dinner at one of the big wineries, and we ate outside on the veranda. That amazing Sonoma sun was setting behind the vineyard, so it was getting rather cool that evening, but we were very comfortable. In fact, the temperature was perfect for an outdoor meal during a cool Sonoma evening. I looked up and around to discover why that temperature was so comfortable and found, yes, you guessed it, an Infratech heater integrated with the design of the wood trellis above our table. All these years later, I know it was an Infratech heater because back at the studio, we were planning a large outdoor space for a client, and outdoor heating was part of that plan, and we ended up specifying 6 Infratech heaters for that project. Their amazing customer support team helped us specify the right units, and we had a very happy and comfortable client. Infratech is specified at the most prestigious properties around the world. Learn why and sign up for a free consultation at infratech-usa.com/podcast. That's infratech-usa.com/podcast. Please visit our platform sponsors today and thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. Do you feel that clients or contractors or people that you work with in the profession have treated you differently as a woman than they did as a man in terms of respect and knowledge and basically the stereotype of an architect and a female architect versus a male architect?
Yeah, they have. And I did have one project where we transitioned right in the middle of construction. And that was very noticeable that, you know, sitting there at the table and go, you know, in the discussion, you know, here's the architect sort of like running the meeting. And the next time, literally like 2 weeks later, it was a completely different dynamic. And you know, and I didn't know. At first I was like, oh, is this because, you know, the transgender issue? Is this because of the being, you know, presenting as a woman? And I sort of concluded, again, it was for a university and an arts project on our university. So, I mean, again, a pretty liberal group. I really came to believe that it was more about being a woman, presenting as a woman. And I have had that happen in other meetings, you know, where they didn't know, they didn't, you know, this is the same thing. There's just that tendency for guys to talk over other guys, you know, talk over other people. And they do it less with, you know, among guys as they do with women. So
what do you do when you run into that situation?
I generally pause and listen. Once in a while, I mean, depending on how long it goes, sometimes I go back and I interrupt them. You know, I'll say, you know, I was talking, you know, let me finish my thought and you can have your thought. If it's just a comment or two, you know, I just let it run. But if they really start going on or trying to command the meeting, you know, I'll say, wait, you know, no, I was talking. I will also do the same thing if I'm sitting there at a meeting and there's other women at the table and somebody interrupts them. I'll stop and say, oh, you know, Janet was talking, you know, let's hear her out. You know, you'll get your turn.
Right. So you need to guide them a little bit.
Yeah. It's, you know, and again, you know, I mean, I heard all this from my mother. I mean, she trained dozens of bosses, you know? My ex was she still is an architect, and you know, would hear it from her, you know, and that, and you know, you'd sort of observe it in the firms, and even then, you know, as presenting as a guy, I mean, I would try to be very careful of not interrupting, not talking over, making sure everybody got a voice at the table. It was always more of a team effort than no, it's my ego and my thing. Unfortunately, especially in the larger firms at the time, it was perceived as much of a, it was kind of perceived as a weakness. It wasn't perceived as a position of strength. And you know, which surprised me. I mean, now everybody talks about this is what we want to do, but even as far, you know, even 10 years ago or 15 years ago, you know, it wasn't perceived that way. And I'm not sure, I think a lot of people play lip service to it. I'm not sure that a lot of the large firms that have these big establishment, you know, bureaucracies, maybe it's more of the mid-sized firms. I think the larger corporate firms, they see it and they want to be trendsetters and they're doing what they can. But the smaller and the mid-sized firms that still have the partner, the original founders and, you know, the old guard and that, they haven't quite as.
Yes. Do you feel that it was, and I'm quite certain it wasn't easy, but do you think it's easier to have transitioned later in your career than it would have been earlier in your career? Because of your accomplishments and what you've accomplished in the past?
Yes. I truly believe that. I feel fortunate about that. In the sense that I did have an established record. I mean, I know several transgender architects that are stealth, that are in their 20s, that they have not told anybody in their employment that, you know, that they're female, that they're, you know, transgender females. They're presenting as that, and because of their age and right combination of early hormones and everything, you know, they could pull it off. But, you know, they're just petrified, to tell, or when they have told, they've sort of gotten even more sidetracked or derailed than some of the women in the firm, not getting the plum projects, or not even in one person's case, they didn't even get client contact anymore. They were just, derailed. So I do feel the combination of experience and age, as you get more confident. The other thing that happened after transitioning was I just, and this is true across the board for almost every transgender person I know, that there's such a relief that you're not hiding anything anymore, that your confidence level goes up. You're more open. I mean, I was always kind of close. I was always told I was closed and angry, too demanding. And now it's like, you're laughing all the time. You're smiling, and I was always high, I was always afraid someone was going to find out, or what if they find out? What if they figure this out? It sort of struck me, it was like, if everybody, and even like, I think a lot of people that aren't transgender always feel like they're hiding, or they've got a shield or a mask up, because they're not really being their true selves for whatever reason, in a corporate structure or a firm structure or the politics of it or whatever. If everybody could feel this open and free, can you imagine how cool that would be? How productive we would be, how innovative ideas, and where we would push this profession in design and problem solving and inclusion of on that. I mean, it would be a whole different world. I think to some extent we're getting there. I mean, I have very high hopes for the current generation of students and interns, and young professionals. I mean, they seem totally just a different acceptance level. But again, being a child of the 60s, I had all those hopes back then.
I think things have changed.
So I hope it sticks this time.
I have two additional questions before I ask my final question. One is, do you have advice for a young architect who is struggling with that decision to transition? And what, I know that's a big question, but having done it and done it at the time that you've done it, and maybe we're talking to younger architects who are those people who are afraid that if they reveal themselves, their life will be different. Do you have any advice for them at all?
Well, I mean, and again, I yes. I think most, if not all, transgender, gender queer, gender questioning, individuals all kind of come to the same point at some time. It's like, this is so bad that I don't care anymore what happens. I'm going to do it. I'm going to jump. And I think when they do jump off the cliff, you do find you have wings, that it really, whether the cliff was just a step and there's, a soft landing. Now, that doesn't mean like, you may not lose your job. I mean, you may lose your job. You may lose, you will lose possibly friends, depending on who you're associated with. I hear horror stories of people losing family and that. But to be honest, I mean, a lot of transgender individuals, the other point is just not pleasant. I mean, there's a suicide hotline for a reason. And that's what a lot of them are debating. And so to put off not being your true self, I think is just, you're going to regret it. You know, you're going to regret every year you were hidden. I mean, you can get over the money, you can get over you can find a new job. There are going to be firms out there if you're talented. There, you know, that find you, that need your talent, need your insight, welcome your insight. You may have to move out of your state. You may have to, you know, whatever. But I just don't. You know, you worked this hard to become an architect. Yeah, and, you know, we all know it's not easy.
Right.
And put in that much dedication, this is a lot. This will give you so much happiness and fulfillment, and you'll be a better architect.
Thank you for sharing that.
I would always do it sooner than later. And I think the times are different. I mean, if I would have done it when I was, you know, 20 or 30, it would have been a totally different time.
Yeah. And that's not necessarily your age. It's more of the time of the society.
It's the time. It was the political thing. You know, and I think back and it's like, I mean, I knew this since I was 8 years old or so. And you go, well, you know, should I have transitioned? And I was like, well, I probably, but I'd have a totally different life. I would still be an architect, but it would be different. Would it be better? Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I mean, the trade-offs, I mean, I had a family, I had kids. I mean, so there's different trade-offs, but you don't know what the future is going to be. So you got to be true to yourself as soon as you can.
And what would you say, Catherine, to people who don't understand, who see you and hear your story, and they just don't get it? Because the reason I ask that question is because an opportunity like this, where you're on the podcast, somebody who's listening may not understand what we're talking about here. Why would you do this? Is there something you can say that can help them better understand what we're talking about?
Well, I mean, I think, again, I mean, if somebody's, I mean, if we equate it to becoming an architect, most architects that I've run into or know seem that it was always a passion. It was very much a burning passion, and they became they went through whatever obstacle they had to become an architect. And you could equate it to kind of the same thing. It's like, well, okay, you've got this burning passion, and now someone's telling you can't do that. You're never going to be, you know, you want to be an architect. You can see it, what architects are. You may even know architects, but you're not going to be it. You can't be that. And it's not because you're not talented enough. It's not because you're not skilled enough, or that you have, you know, the knowledge, whatever, or the drive. You're just never going to be it. And so, what would that do to you? Or, you know, you could say a painter or an artist or, you know, whatever, or your passion's fly fishing. You know, you can never fly fish again. You can sit on the shore and watch, but you can never do it again. You know, so to have that sort of burning desire or passion essentially taken away or never be able to realize, I mean, what would that do to you? That would eat you up. That would put a hole in you. That would make you mean and angry.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's the same thing. It's just a driving itch that you can't scratch. I mean, and there's all sorts of debates about, you know, mental, well, they're not debates anymore. It's medically proven. But there's a lot of misunderstanding about sexuality and orientation and gender and all that. But you don't go through this transition. You don't do this on a lark. I mean, this is a difficult road. Without getting into all the details, it's not easy.
Yeah. Catherine, thank you for sharing that. Let's wrap things up with our final question. We're talking to thousands of small firm architects right now. What's one thing that you would say that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
Well, For me, the hardest part, is the business side of it. I mean, really, you really have to focus on that. And I think, and getting a good, I mean, if it's a sole proprietor, you still need to have that, a good backup person, a good project manager, a good draftsman, a good project, you know, architect or whatever. That's what I sort of still struggle with, is finding those good backup people.
Yeah.
And when you're on that cusp of, well, we can't right now, I mean, we can't take a lot of staff, but we need more staff, you know, it's like you're always with, and marketing. I'm just horrible at marketing and getting stuff out, you know, and staying current with stuff. You know, there's so much competition out there from the larger firms, from the design build people, from, you know, whatever. I mean, it's hard. I think probably the other thing that disturbs me is this is bigger than everything else, is we don't always perceive ourselves as bringing as much value to a client as we do. And you know, a lot of times, you know, and I was having this discussion with a firm, an owner of a smaller firm last week. And they were saying, well, you know, we had to compete with fees and all that kind of stuff. And I go, well, no, we don't want to compete on fees, you know. And it was like, and I always remember what I heard a lecture from Sir Foster once. And he was like, you know, we work for nothing. Well, he doesn't work for nothing. He charges 22%.
Right.
But he works for nothing because when he gets done, he's beta tested it. He's tested it enough and done his homework that the client basically saved so much money and made his product so much better that 22% is meaningless. That's where we have to be. We bring so much value to a client and so much value to a project, whether it's someone's house or someone, you know, they live better, or someone's company. I mean, if it's a company or something like, they're in it to make money. Well, then make them more efficient. They'll make more money. They don't care what they pay you, you know? So I don't see that as in our profession as much as we should. We've got a lot. So many times we get this commodity mentality. It drives me nuts.
It's a very wise answer to that question. I appreciate that. Her name is Catherine Georgeson, FAIA. The firm name is Orchestra Design Studio. If you want to go see the work that Catherine's doing, stagearc.com. So it's ARCH, stagearc.com is the website. Catherine, I appreciate you for coming on with me and having this conversation and being so transparent and honest with your story. I hope that others hear it. I hope the people who need to hear it to understand will hear it. I also hope that people who are in a similar situation as you, who are struggling with their identity, can learn something from our conversation as well. So thank you very much for coming on today and sharing your knowledge and your experience here today at Entree Architect Podcast.
Well, thank you, Mark, for giving me this opportunity. And certainly, I mean, if there are transgender architects or somebody that's out there that's struggling or something, please, I mean, just be up, send me an email. I'm on Facebook, send me up, you know, I'm easy to find. And I would love to hear from you or talk to you or help you through any questions or counseling.
Thank you, Catherine. Catherine's very active in the private Facebook group. So you can go to entrearchitect.com/group, entrearchitect.com/group will get you right into the Facebook group. And you can just search for Catherine there and you'll find her, and you can send her a DM and ask her any questions you might have. Catherine, thank you again. I appreciate you.
This has been great. Thank you.
If you like this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a rating, write a review, and share a link to this episode with a friend. That's how Entree Architect will grow to serve thousands more architects just like you. Thank you to our sponsors, RCAT, FreshBooks, and Infratech Comfort Heaters, for their support of this episode. Links to our sponsors and all the resources we discussed today are available at the show notes for this episode, found at entrearchitect.com slash podcast. Entree Architect is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. Gable Media is curated thought leadership for an audience dedicated to building a better world. Listen and subscribe to all the shows at GableMedia.com. That's GABLmedia.com. And check out Entree Architect Academy membership. Ready to edit business resources, live monthly business training for architects, a supportive architect community, and Simple Systems, our new business system program developed for small firm entrepreneur architects just like you. It's all waiting for you right now at Entree Architect Academy membership, including AIA Continuing Education Learning Units. Come join me and hundreds of your entrepreneur architect peers. Visit entrearchitect.com/join to enroll today. Thank you for listening. Love, learn, and share what you know.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure, and when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.